Usually when we talk about having a numerical advantage in like a competitive environment, whether that's a battlefield or a boardroom, there's this overarching expectation of inevitability.
Right, yeah, like it's a foregone conclusion.
Exactly. Think of a literal tug of war. If you have five incredibly strong people pulling on one side of a thick rope, and the other team only has four people of, equal strength, the physics just take over.
Yep, brute force wins.
Right. The team with five wins, it's clean. The math dictates the outcome. And honestly, our brains find that very comforting.
Oh, absolutely. We constantly seek out that kind of binary categorization. We want to believe that possessing 20% more human capital on a given playing surface guarantees a proportional, visible outcome. But a hockey rink actively resists that kind of linear logic.
Which is exactly why we are dedicating this entire deep dive to the most chaotic, misunderstood, and high-stakes moments in the sport.
So welcome in, everyone. Today, we are not just skimming the surface of ice hockey strategy.
No, we really aren't. We've pulled together an absolute mountain of sources to build a masterclass for you on special teams. So that's the power play and the penalty kill.
And we're pulling from some incredible material here. We've got Alan Wells's analysis of the massive passing project data. We're digging into Eric Parnass's special teams tracking metrics.
Matt Cain's historical league-wide formation data, too.
Exactly. And we are literally opening up the NHL, IIHF, and USA Hockey rulebooks to find those hidden tactical levers that coaches use to manipulate the game.
The goal here is to construct a resilient mental model of strategic advantage for you. So by the time we finish this discussion, you will understand the geometry, the psychology, and the rulebook warfare of uneven strength hockey.
Well enough to coach a local team, explain the nuances to a friend sitting next to you at a game, or just, completely shift your own paradigm of how you watch the sport.
Right. And to do that, we have to start by throwing out that tug-of-war analogy completely.
Oh, yeah, toss it out.
Because when you step onto a sheet of ice, you're entering a strategic landscape that is incredibly murky. It's like a chessboard played at 30 miles an hour. Having an extra piece doesn't guarantee you anything if you don't know how to manipulate the board.
It really doesn't.
So let's establish our baseline here. What is the fundamental governing law of special teams?
Okay, so the golden rule, the absolute core principle that every successful coach builds your system around is this. The extra skater is worth absolutely nothing until it forces somebody on the defending team to cover two players at the exact same time.
I want to pause and really anchor that for everyone listening because it sounds simple, but the implications are massive.
They are. It is exclusively an exercise in manufacturing or on the defensive side, preventing a localized two-on-one matchup.
So if a power play unit steps onto the ice, wins the faceoff, and just stands perfectly still in their designated spots.
Yeah, they don't actually have an advantage.
It's crazy to think about.
But it's true. Functionally, a static 5-on-4 power play is just a 4-on-4 hockey game with a spare man standing somewhere completely irrelevant.
Is the defense just matches up?
Exactly. If the attacking team refuses to move the puck or themselves with purpose, the penalty kill simply assigns their four defenders to the four most dangerous attackers. They can completely ignore the fifth man if that fifth man isn't in a position to receive a pass and immediately shoot.
Wow. Okay, so the mathematical advantage only translates into a tactical advantage when the penalty kill is forced into a state of panic, basically.
Right, when one defender realizes they have two immediate threats to worry about and only one physical body to neutralize them.
Okay, let's unpack this because that brings us to the mechanics of how you actually induce that panic. You manufacture that two-on-one using puck movement, not just leg speed.
Precisely.
I always thought of it like a game of keep away in a swimming pool.
Well, that's a good analogy.
Right. If you're in the deep end trying to run away from the person who is it, you're incredibly slow. The water drags you down. Your physical speed is mitigated by the environment.
Sure.
But if you have a ball and you throw it over the defender's head to your friend on the other side of the pool, the ball travels through the air completely unbothered by the water.
It moves infinitely faster than the defender can wade across the pool to stop it.
Exactly.
Yes.
And that physical reality translates perfectly to the ice.
It really does. A puck sliding on frozen water travels vastly faster than a human being on skates. But more importantly, a penalty kill operates as a connected geometric shape.
Like a box or a diamond, right?
Yeah, usually a box or diamond. And that entire shape has to shift and travel to cover the puck. Every crisp tape-to-tape pass forces at least one, and usually multiple penalty killers, to stop, change direction, and aggressively skate to a new spot.
And killers who are skating are killers who are arriving late.
Right. For the 2 seconds before they arrive, you have your localized two-on-one.
Because, I mean, a defensive unit can theoretically cover any single passing option or shooting lane. But human biomechanics dictate that they cannot cover three different rapidly changing options in a two-second window.
They just can't. Passing stretches the kill faster and more violently than skating ever could.
Yeah.
Like, two rapid passes will distort a defensive box further out of its structured shape than 30 seconds of a highly skilled forward just stick handling in place on the half wall trying to beat a guy one-on-one.
So we have this governing philosophy of movement, but movement has to originate from a structured starting point. You don't just skate randomly around the zone and hope a passing lane opens up.
No, that would be a disaster.
Use formations. Let's dig into the geometry of where these players are actually standing, starting with the dominant structure of the modern era, the 1-3-1.
Okay, yeah. But before we get into the exact mechanics of the 1-3-1, we need to clarify something that often trips up fans.
What's that?
These formations are coaching choices. They are not rules mandated by the sport, and who stands where within them is highly fluid.
Oh, sure.
Every formation we discuss is a living, breathing ecosystem designed to exploit specific weaknesses in certain defensive structures while simultaneously leaving itself vulnerable to others.
Right. So if you're a forward jumping over the boards for a power play shift, you better know exactly which geometric shape your coach wants you to build.
You have to. If you're freelancing and standing like 3 feet away from your assigned node, you are actively destroying the passing angles for your teammates.
Yeah, the seam your quarterback is looking for suddenly doesn't exist because you're standing in it.
Exactly. So the 1-3-1 demands absolute spatial awareness. You have one player operating high at the point, acting as the quarterback.
Okay, that's the one at the top.
Right. Then you have three players stretched laterally across the middle of the offensive zone. Two on the half walls and one sitting right in the very center of the slot, known as the bumper.
That's the three.
Yep. And finally, you have a net front presence operating on the edge of the blue paint, hunching for screens and deflections. That's your final one.
Now, I want to bring in some data here. Matt Cain's research looked at this extensively. He measured that units featuring four forwards and one defenseman, accounted for roughly 56% of 5-on-4 ice time across the league back in the 2016-17 season.
That's a huge chunk.
And visually, we know almost all of those units were running some variation of a 1-3-1. It has basically become the absolute default.
It has. Though we should note that that 56% figure measures the personnel, four forwards and one defenseman across the whole league's ice time, rather than a rigid count of the formation itself.
Okay. Good distinction.
But the eye test confirms it, you know. The 1-3-1 is ubiquitous, and the reason for its dominance lies in how it perfectly counters the traditional four-man defensive box.
Let's break down why that is. Start with the quarterback at the point. What makes a good distributor in that spot? Because it's not just about having a heavy slap shot anymore, is it?
No, a heavy shot is almost secondary now. The quarterback's primary job is lateral movement along the blue line.
Just walking the line?
Exactly. By walking the line, taking two or three hard lateral strides, they change the geometric angle of every single passing lane in the entire zone. A lane that was blocked by a defender's shin pads suddenly opens up.
And it forces the defense to shift their eyes, right?
Yes. It physically turns the heads of the penalty killers, forcing them to look away from the other attackers to track the puck.
And when they distribute the puck, it usually goes to those two players on the half walls, the decision makers. And there is a massive biomechanical advantage built into where these guys are standing, right? They almost always play on their off wing.
The off-wing setup is non-negotiable for an elite 1-3-1.
So a left-handed shooter plays on the right side of the ice.
Right, and a right-handed shooter plays on the left. This puts the blade of their stick toward the middle of the ice.
Why is that so critical?
Because when a pass comes their way, their body is already opened up to the entire offensive zone. They don't have to stop the puck, pivot their hips, and then look for a play.
They can just fire away.
Exactly. They can receive the pass and immediately fire a one-timer or instantly touch pass it to another teammate, all in one fluid motion.
Okay, so you have the quarterback changing angles and the half wall guys loaded up for one-timers. But what ties the whole room together, it's that guy standing right in the middle, the bumper.
The bumper.
I feel like this is the most unappreciated, terrifying position to play in all of hockey.
Oh, it absolutely is. The bumper is the linchpin that breaks a traditional defensive box. If you visualize a four-man penalty kill box, two guys high, two guys low, there is a massive gaping hole right in the very center of that structure.
Because they're all on the perimeter.
Right. Nobody is assigned to the middle of the slot.
Yeah.
So the bumper player essentially sets up camp right in that empty real estate.
But they are surrounded by four defenders who all have sticks swinging around. I mean, that sounds miserable.
It requires immense bravery and elite spatial cognition. The bumper's job is to keep their stick free, blade flat on the ice, providing a constant, terrifying outlet for the half-wall players.
So they're always an option.
Always. If a penalty killer steps out toward the half-wall to apply pressure, the half-wall player simply slips the puck into the middle to the bumper for a point-blank one-touch shot.
Oh, wow.
Furthermore, the bumper physically holds the high penalty killers down. If the high killers want to aggressively pressure the point, they have to skate past the bumper, leaving a lethal scorer completely alone in the most dangerous part of the ice.
That is such a cool dynamic. So the 1-3-1 is brilliant because it actively exploits the center of the ice. Mm. But what if a team wants to pull the defense apart differently? What if they run the umbrella?
Yeah.
Because that formation completely ignores the bumper position.
Yeah, the umbrella is a totally different philosophy. It features three players high in an arc near the blue line and two players positioned low near the goal line or the lower circles. Mm-hmm. It literally mimics the curved canopy and handle of an umbrella.
Right.
And by doing this, it deliberately vacates the center of the slot.
But wait. If we just establish that the center of the slot is the most dangerous area on the ice, why would a coaching staff ever design a system that intentionally abandons it?
It's a concession designed to create a different kind of high danger event. By removing the bumper player, you also remove the defensive traffic that naturally congregates around him.
Ah, clearing the lanes.
Exactly. The umbrella is designed to give the three high players completely clean, unobstructed shooting lanes to the net. You use it when you have elite shooters at the point and the flanks, and you want them bombing pucks from distance while one of your low players sets a massive screen directly in the goaltender's eyes.
So it relies heavily on traffic at the net rather than intricate interior passing.
That's it. It's a bomber strategy.
Okay, I can see the logic there. Now let's tackle the overload.
Oh.
This formation has always messed with my head. You essentially crowd four of your five players onto one side of the ice, say the left side.
Yep.
You've got a guy below the goal line, a guy in the corner, a guy on the half wall, and a guy at the point. And then you have one lone sniper just hanging out by himself on the completely opposite side of the ice.
It looks entirely counterintuitive, doesn't it?
It looks like terrible strategy. You're doing the defense's job for them. You're voluntarily putting all your guys in a phone booth, making it incredibly easy for the penalty kill to just collapse on that side, pin you to the boards, and trap you. Why would you want to play 4-on-4 on a quarter of the ice?
I completely understand why it looks that way, but if we connect this to our golden rule, creating 2-on-1s, the overload is a strategy of relentless local superiority.
Goal superiority, okay.
Yes, you are crowding one side, but by putting four highly skilled attackers in a small area against maybe two or three defenders who rotate into that space, you are repeatedly creating micro 3-on-2 matchups along the board.
So you are basically daring them to come get the puck.
Exactly. You cycle the puck relentlessly between those four players in tight quarters. You make short, rapid passes. Eventually, human nature takes over and a penalty killer overcommits.
They get impatient.
Right. They get frustrated. They step out of their structural assignment to try and steal the puck. And the moment they do, a seam opens up.
And when that seam opens?
You strike. You either attack that newly created lane for a drive to the net or you execute the most devastating play in the overload. The skip pass.
Oh, I love the skip pass.
It's beautiful. You fire a hard pass all the way across the ice through the defensive box to that lone weak side player. The penalty kill has completely shifted their weight to one side. The goaltender is hugging the post on that side. And suddenly the puck is 50 feet away on the stick of a waiting sniper with half an empty net to shoot at.
It's a giant trap. You're baiting them into abandoning their structure. But what's the risk? Because there's always a trade-off.
The risk is that those tight, short passes on the strong side are easily intercepted if the defensive structure refuses to break.
And if they intercept it?
It's bad. If a penalty killer reads the cycle, picks off a pass on the half wall, they are already facing up ice with tremendous momentum, and it immediately turns into a shorthanded breakaway against you. The overload requires exceptional puck protection skills.
High risk, high reward. And just for the sake of covering all our bases, we should mention the classic 2-3 formation. Two defensemen at the points, three forwards down low. You see this everywhere in youth hockey and beer leagues.
You do. It is safe, it is traditional, and at the professional level, it is virtually extinct as a primary setup.
Why is that?
Well, having two defensemen locked at the blue line provides excellent security against shorthanded breakaways. But strategically, it is deeply flawed. Think about a standard four-man defensive box. Its inherent strengths are protecting the points and protecting the immediate goal mouth.
Okay.
The 2-3 formation attacks the exact areas the box is built to defend while completely ignoring the vulnerable, unassigned middle of the slot. Against a disciplined, modern penalty kill, a 2-3 formation is close to harmless.
All right, let's pause and make sure we are cementing this mental model for you guys listening. So, what should we remember here? The goal is to create two-on-ones through passing. We understand the formations, the 1-3-1, the umbrella, the overload, and how they manipulate space.
Right.
Now, let's talk about execution. What are the specific high-leverage plays that actually put the puck in the back of the net? I want to focus on this concept of the Royal Road. If someone listening wants to understand modern hockey analytics in one visual concept, this is it.
It really is. The Royal Road, often referred to as the slot line by coaches, is an imaginary line running straight down the exact center of the ice from the middle of one net to the middle of the other.
So it splits the ice in half lengthwise.
Yes. It splits the offensive zone perfectly in half. If an attacking team can complete a pass that crosses this imaginary line immediately before taking a shot, it absolutely destroys the goaltender's mathematical geometry.
Walk us through the biomechanics of that. Why does crossing that specific line matter so much? Why is it harder for a goalie to stop a shot coming off a cross-ice pass than a shot coming straight down the wing?
It comes down to how a goaltender tracks the puck and establishes their stance. When a puck is on the left side of the ice, the goalie pushes out from the goal line, establishes their depth, and gets perfectly square to the shooter.
Right.
Their angles are covered, their feet are set. If the shooter simply shoots the puck from there, the goalie is in a position of maximum strength.
They're a wall.
Exactly. But then the pass goes across the Royal Road.
And everything changes.
The moment the puck crosses that center dividing line, everything the goalie has established is ruined. They cannot simply rotate their torso. They must completely break their stance, dig an edge into the ice, and make a violent, explosive lateral push to the opposite side of the crease to face the new threat.
And while they are sliding?
While they are sliding, they are exceptionally vulnerable. Their body naturally opens up, creating holes under their arms and between their pads. They lose their depth because a lateral push almost always carries a goalie slightly backward toward the goal line.
Right, they drift back.
And crucially, their eyes have to acquire a new target moving at high speed. The pass forces a massive mechanical reset, and an elite shooter will release the puck before the goaltender can reestablish their stance and seal the ice.
And the tracking data validates this theory emphatically, doesn't it?
It does. We have to look at the deep dive into the passing project data, that massive volunteer-led effort that tracked over 51,000 shot attempts at 5-on-5 even strength.
51,000. That's a huge sample size.
It is. And the analysis found that a pass crossing the Royal Road immediately before a shot yielded a roughly 15.5% finishing rate.
15.5%. That's huge in a sport where average shooting percentages are often in the single digits.
It is essentially double the conversion rate of the next most valuable passing option. Now, it is vital to contextualize this data properly. This 15.5% figure was derived from 5-on-5 even strength play, counting all shot attempts, not exclusively the power play.
Okay, good caveat.
You will frequently hear broadcasters or coaches claim that Royal Road passes on the power play convert at 25 or 30%. There is no published, rigorously tracked primary source for those inflated numbers. The 15.5% baseline is the grounded, verified data.
Still, it's massive.
But the direction and magnitude of the effect are undeniable. Forcing the goalie to move laterally across the slot line is the holy grail of offensive hockey.
This completely reframes how you watch a game. Next time you see a team passing the puck endlessly around the perimeter without shooting and the crowd is screaming, "Shoot the puck!" You'll realize they aren't passing just to pass.
Right, they're not just wasting time.
They are probing the defense, waiting for a lane to open up across that Royal Road.
Exactly. The fans want a shot, but the players know that a low probability shot from the outside is just a turnover. They are hunting for the geometric breakdown.
Let's talk about another staple of the power play, the point shot. I think there's a massive misconception here that defensemen are trying to blow the puck past the goalie from 60 feet away.
If a defenseman is shooting from the blue line with the intention of beating an NHL goaltender clean with no screen, they are wasting a possession.
It's just a waste.
Goaltenders are simply too athletic and their equipment is too large. They will save an unscreened 60-foot shot 99 times out of 100. A point shot is not an attempt to score directly. It is a delivery system.
You're delivering the puck into chaos.
You are delivering the puck to the net front player. The point shot should only be taken when two conditions are met. First, your net front player has established dominant physical position and is completely obstructing the goaltender's vision.
So the goalie literally can't see the release.
Right. And second, you have changed the angle. A defenseman must walk the blue line laterally for a few strides before shooting.
Why is that lateral movement so important again?
If they shoot from a static position, the penalty killer standing in front of them will just block it. By walking the line, the defenseman pulls the puck out of the established blocking lane, ensuring it reaches the net front where it can be tipped, deflected, or generate a rebound.
Makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the backdoor play, the highlight reel tap in at the far post.
No.
What is the secret to executing that consistently? Because it seems like every time I watch a team try it, the pass gets picked off.
The entire secret to the backdoor play is timing, specifically the discipline of arriving late.
Arriving late.
Yes. If you are the weak side player and you simply skate to the far post and stand there for 10 seconds with your stick on the ice, you are dead to the play. A penalty killer will look over their shoulder, see you standing there, and physically tie up your stick.
You're just marking yourself.
You are doing the defender's job for them. The elite backdoor players, guys who make a living tapping pucks into empty nets, are masters of camouflage.
I love that. Camouflage.
They hide in the weak side weeds, often drifting slightly higher in the zone, making themselves appear non-threatening. They do not commit to the post until the exact millisecond the passer winds up.
Oh, wow.
When the pass is released, they explode toward the post. Because they arrive simultaneously with the puck, they are practically invisible to the defender until it is entirely too late.
It's a synchronized strike. You time it, you do not camp out. Okay, so we have mapped out these devastating in-zone plays, the 1-3-1, the Royal Road, the backdoor timing. But here is where this gets incredibly frustrating for fans and honestly for coaches. A lot of people assume power plays fail because they can't execute these plays in the offensive zone.
But that's a massive misconception.
Right. Power plays usually die before they even cross the blue line.
The zone entry is the bottleneck of special teams. If you cannot get five players in the puck through a narrow gateway guarded by four compact, aggressive defenders, your beautiful 1-3-1 formation is entirely theoretical.
It doesn't even matter.
This is the great irony of amateur hockey. Teams will spend hours at practice working on their in-zone passing sequences and allocate perhaps 5 minutes to practicing how to actually enter the zone. Then they wonder why they spend a two-minute power play retrieving the puck from their own end.
So how do professional teams solve this blue line problem? The most polarizing, discussed tactic is the drop pass entry. You see this constantly on TV. A star player gathers speed in their own end, flies through the neutral zone, hits the red line, and just as the defense steps up to challenge him, he seemingly abandons the puck, leaving it dead in his wake for a trailing teammate to pick up. Fans absolutely lose their minds over this. They scream at the television, just skate it in.
It is visually jarring to watch a player with immense speed suddenly surrender the puck. But the underlying mechanics of the drop pass explain exactly why it is so heavily utilized. It is a brilliant manipulation of defensive momentum.
Break that down for us. Why does leaving the puck behind you actually help you gain the zone?
When that first attacker comes screaming up the middle of the ice, the four penalty killers have to respect that speed. They establish their defensive gap and begin skating backward toward their own zone to match his velocity. They mentally commit to stopping him at the blue line.
They lock onto the target.
Exactly. But when the attacker executes the drop pass, he leaves the puck effectively stationary for a fraction of a second. The trailing teammate, coming from behind with immense speed, swoops in to pick it up.
Okay, so the puck carrier changes.
Right, but the defenders cannot instantly stop their backward momentum. They are caught drifting backward, expecting to defend the first guy. Suddenly, the puck carrier has changed, but the speed of the attack has not.
Oh, so they're out of position.
The defense has committed their momentum and their gap control to the wrong player. A massive cushion of space opens up, allowing the trailing player to carry the puck clean over the blue line.
That is so smart. And there is hard data to prove that this isn't just a coaching fad. It actually works.
It does. Eric Parnass's tracking data for the Special Teams Project, which analyzed zone entries across 6 NHL teams, provided concrete validation. The data showed that drop pass entries produced 0.84 shot attempts per entry.
And what about normal entries?
Traditional carry-ins or dump-and-chase entries produced only 0.70 shot attempts per entry. That difference over the course of a season is massive.
But I have to push back a little here. I read that same study, and there is a significant tax you pay for running the drop pass. It takes a long time to set up. You have guys looping back in their own end, waiting for the play to develop. You're bleeding time off the clock before you even attack.
That is the critical trade-off, and you are absolutely right to highlight it. Parnass's data showed that drop pass entries took an average of 15.5 seconds to execute from puck retrieval to zone entry. Regular entries took only 12.6 seconds.
So you're losing almost 3 seconds every time.
You are essentially paying a 3-second tax on a 2-minute power play every single time you attempt it. If you have to break out 3 times, you've wasted 10% of your advantage just skating in circles in your own end.
So how do coaches justify that tax? I mean, time is precious on the power play.
The justification is shot quality and sustained possession. A chaotic, fast entry might save 3 seconds, but it often results in an immediate turnover along the boards, forcing you to skate all the way back down the ice again, which costs another 15 seconds. The 0.84 shot attempts generated by a clean drop pass entry mathematically outweigh the lost 3 seconds.
Quality over speed. But you can't just run it every single time, right? The defense isn't blind. They watch film, too.
That is the danger. If a team becomes entirely predictable, an aggressive penalty kill will anticipate the drop pass. A killer will step up at the red line, intercept the drop, and immediately be in on a shorthanded breakaway because the power play's defensemen are usually caught flat-footed moving up ice. The optimal practical application is to have a robust traditional entry scheme and utilize the drop pass as a potent variation, or switch to it when your primary scheme is struggling.
Okay, let's pause and summarize the mental model for our first major topic so y'all can really lock this in. What should we remember here? The power play is fundamentally an exercise in manufacturing a localized 2-on-1.
Correct.
You achieve that through rapid passing that forces the penalty kill to skate and arrive late.
Yeah.
You utilize formations like the 1-3-1 to exploit the unassigned center of the ice. You actively hunt for passes across the Royal Road to destroy the goaltender's mechanical tracking. And you recognize that a meticulously controlled zone entry, even if it takes longer, is exponentially more valuable than a fast, chaotic one.
That is an excellent synthesis.
Yeah.
And to add one final piece to that model, if an attacking player is trying to enter the zone, faces a wall of 4 defenders, and loses the puck at the blue line with 4 teammates trapped up ice ahead of him, well, that is the single most common scenario that leads to a shorthanded goal against.
Ah, because everyone is caught going the wrong way.
Right. You have the extra man. You can afford to regroup and try again. The penalty kill cannot afford to make a mistake. Do not force an entry that isn't there.
Great advice. All right, let's turn the dial up. We've established the physics of a 5-on-4 advantage. What happens when the math gets even worse for the defense? What happens when a second player takes a penalty and it becomes a 5-on-3, a 2-man advantage?
A 5-on-3 is not simply a better power play. It is a completely different sport governed by entirely different rules of engagement. If a power play unit steps onto the ice for a 5-on-3 and tries to run their standard 1-3-1, they will likely fail and they will absolutely waste their supreme advantage.
Why is the transition so jarring? It's just one less defender out there.
Because removing that 4th defender fundamentally alters the geometric reality for the penalty kill. 4 defenders can build a box. 3 defenders cannot.
So what do they do?
3 penalty killers are forced into a tight, compact triangle, usually anchored right around the hash marks in the goal mouth. 2 players low near the posts, 1 player high in the middle.
They basically form a protective shell around the goalie.
Exactly. And here is the crucial consequence of that shell. They must concede absolutely everything outside of it. Sustained pressure on the puck carrier on the perimeter is physically impossible.
Because if they step out,
if any one of those 3 killers leaves the triangle to chase the puck into the corner or out to the blue line, they open a massive, unfillable void in the most dangerous area of the ice.
So wait, if they can't leave the triangle and nobody's coming out to the perimeter to pressure you, then patience is your ultimate weapon. You have all the time in the world.
That is the ultimate aha moment for a power play unit on a 5-on-3. No penalty killer is coming to hunt you down. The only way you lose your time and space is if you panic, rush a play, and force a bad pass into shin pads.
So how do you exploit it?
To exploit this, the attacking team abandons the tight formations and shifts into a spread or a box shape. You put two players extremely low, wide of goalposts. You put two players high and wide near the blue line. And you put one player directly in the middle.
You are stretching the zone to its absolute physical limit.
You are making that tiny three-man defensive triangle try to cover 60 feet of ice. It is mathematically impossible.
And once you have them stretched out, how do you break the goalie? Do you just wait for a mistake?
You use the Royal Road, but with even more extreme lateral movement. You do not just lazily pass the puck around the perimeter. You whip the puck side to side entirely across the zone, forcing the goaltender to make massive lateral pushes back and forth.
Until they break.
You do not shoot from the outside into a wall of three desperate shot blockers. You wait. You wait for the goaltender to finally lose their footing, lose their edge, or get caught leaning, and then you strike with a far post one-timer or a quick tap-in on the second wave.
And there is a massive rulebook nuance here that governs exactly how a 5-on-3 operates, and I see fans get confused by this constantly. If you score a goal on a 5-on-3, the power play isn't over. The other team doesn't just get both of their guys back.
Correct. The mechanics of expiring penalties are very specific. Under NHL rules, when a team scores a goal against a shorthanded opponent, only one penalty terminates. Crucially, it is the minor penalty with the least amount of time remaining on the clock that comes off the board.
So the guy who's been sitting in the box the longest gets to leave.
Yes. So if you score on a 5-on-3, it merely graduates you to a 5-on-4 power play. The second penalty remains active. Furthermore, if the power play unit recognizes this quickly, they can pull the puck out of the net, line up for the center ice faceoff, and attack immediately while the penalty kill is still traumatized and trying to reorganize their lines for a four-man rotation.
Unless one of the penalties is a major penalty, right?
Exactly. Major penalties, five-minute infractions, are served in their entirety, regardless of how many goals are scored, under both NHL and IIHF rules. If you are on a 5-on-3 where one penalty is a minor and one is a major, and you score, only the minor penalty can terminate.
What if you score on a penalty shot?
If you score on a penalty shot, that releases absolutely nobody from the penalty box. But in the vast majority of standard two-man advantages, scoring a goal just resets the board to a standard power play.
Okay, let's flip the board completely. We've spent this entire time talking about how the power play stretches the ice, utilizes geometry, and leverages the math to break the defense. But if you're the four guys on the other side of that equation, if you are the penalty kill, how do you survive?
Yeah,
you can't
yeah.
just skate faster to make up for the missing man.
You survive through the art of controlled concession. The core philosophy of a successful penalty kill can be distilled into a harsh truth. You cannot cover five professional hockey players with only four bodies. Stop trying.
I mean, it sounds so defeatist. It sounds like you're telling him to just give up.
It isn't defeatist. It is cold pragmatism. Discipline beats effort on a penalty kill every single time. A player who tries to give 110% effort by skating wildly around the zone trying to cover two guys at once will destroy their own team's structure and give up a backdoor tap-in.
Right.
This raises the most important question a defensive coach must answer. Which specific shot are you willing to give up?
Oh, I see. You're acknowledging that they're going to get a shot eventually, so you are choosing your poison. You're dictating the terms of your own surrender.
Exactly. A penalty kill is simply a calculated decision about which specific area of the ice you are willing to leave undefended, followed by 2 minutes of absolute militant discipline, ensuring that the shot you decided to concede is the only shot the opponent gets.
So you're managing time, really.
Time is your only ally. 2 minutes is not a long time in the grand scheme of a game. Conceding three long, easily seen shots from the point while never breaking your defensive shape is infinitely better than conceding zero shots for 40 seconds and then completely breaking down and giving up a glorious cross-crease one-timer.
Okay, so let's look at how they organize that concession. The shape everyone learns when they are a kid is the box.
The box is the foundational block of penalty killing. It is a rectangle stationed around the slot. You have two forwards playing high, roughly aligned with the face-off dots, and two defensemen playing low, protecting the goalposts and the lower slot. The four players move as a single connected unit, sliding laterally with the puck while maintaining their spacing.
But based on what you just said, every kill concedes something. What is the box intentionally giving up?
The box inherently concedes the absolute center of the slot. By positioning four players on the perimeter of a rectangle, you leave a gaping hole in the middle.
Which goes right back to what we said earlier.
Right. This is precisely why the 1-3-1 power play, with its bumper player stationed right in the center, became the modern standard. The bumper stands directly in the hollowed-out center of the box.
So if a team is just shredding your box with that bumper player, slipping passes into the middle for point-blank shots, how do you adapt? You change the shape? You switch to the diamond?
Correct. The diamond rotates the alignment. It features one player high at the apex near the blue line, two players in the middle on either side of the slot, and one player low near the crease.
And how does that solve the bumper problem?
Because you now have two players, the left and right points of the diamond, pinching the middle of the ice from either side. They effectively squeeze the bumper out of existence. There is no soft spot in the center anymore.
But again, the math dictates a concession. You solve the center, so what did you give up?
You gave up width and you gave up low support. The diamond is narrow. A hard cross-seam pass from one half wall to the other completely pulls the diamond apart because the middle players have to travel too far to cover the width.
I see.
Furthermore, because there is only one player at the bottom of the diamond, that lone defender is left isolated to handle both a net front screen and a potential backdoor threat. You are actively choosing to concede a localized two-on-one near your own net to protect the high slot.
It's like choosing which leaky pipe in your house to put a bucket under. You only have one bucket. You can't fix the plumbing. You're short a guy. So you just have to control the damage and decide which room gets flooded.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it. You are managing the flood. Now, if a team wants to aggressively protect the high danger areas around the net at all costs, they might deploy the wedge plus one, also known as the triangle in one.
I've heard coaches talk about this, but it sounds incredibly complicated to execute at NHL speeds.
It is incredibly demanding on the player's cognitive load. In a wedge plus one, three killers form a very tight, impenetrable triangle or wedge right around the front of the net. Two defensemen anchor the bottom corners just off the crease, and one forward sits at the mid to high slot.
Okay, so a triangle.
Their mandate is strict. Stay tight, protect the goal mouth, block shots, and absolutely do not chase the puck to the perimeter.
They build a fortress.
Okay.
And what does the fourth guy do?
The fourth player, the plus one, acts as a heat-seeking missile. Their job is to aggressively pressure whoever has the puck on the perimeter, forcing rushed decisions and making every possession uncomfortable.
That sounds perfect. You get absolute protection in front of the net, and you get aggressive pressure on the puck. Why doesn't everyone run this?
Because the execution required is staggering. When the plus one pressures the puck and the attacking team passes it to a new area of the ice, the plus one cannot just chase it endlessly. They will get exhausted and pulled out of position.
So they have to tag out.
Yes. The moment the puck moves, the plus one must immediately sprint back and drop into the triangle fortress, and whichever player in the wedge is now closest to the puck must instantly step out and become the new plus one.
Oh, wow. So they are constantly rotating roles. That's a ton of communication.
It is. Everyone must know exactly who is the missile and who is the fortress every single second. I'm out, you're in. If two players jump out at the same time, the fortress breaks. If nobody jumps out, the power play has infinite time to set up a shot.
What if the guy just keeps chasing?
If the plus one just chases the puck around the perimeter like a lost puppy, the shape fractures entirely and you are effectively trying to kill a penalty with only three structured players.
Yeah.
It requires intense verbal communication and thousands of hours of practice to execute seamlessly.
Let's talk more about that pressure. Aside from the structural shapes, a penalty kill has to decide on its pressure settings. Passive versus aggressive.
Passive penalty killing means holding your structure rigidly, keeping sticks in passing lanes, and waiting for the power play to make an unforced error. You bleed the clock and prioritize safety. Aggressive penalty killing means actively attacking the puck carrier to force chaos and turnovers.
Like the check press.
Right. The check press is a famous aggressive scheme where the high forward on the kill genuinely attacks the power play's point player, trying to force a fumble at the blue line.
I saw some data from Matt Cain suggesting that aggressive penalty kills actually perform better over a season. If that's true, why wouldn't every team just attack constantly?
You have to be incredibly careful with how you interpret that specific data. He did build a PK aggressiveness statistic, and he found it correlated positively with better outcomes, like goal differential. However, as it was pointed out when analyzing that same study, That metric largely measured offensive opportunism while shorthanded.
What does that mean? How's that different?
It measured how often a penalty kill generated zone entries and shot attempts when they gained possession of the puck. It measured counterattacks. It did not measure how aggressively they chased the puck around their own defensive zone when the other team had it.
Ah, I see the distinction.
The structural reality of hockey remains undefeated. If you aggressively pressure the puck in your own zone and you miss the steal, you are now defending five elite attackers with only three killers in position. Chaos with a numerical disadvantage is rarely your friend.
Which brings us to a crucial point. The best place to defend a power play isn't in your own zone. It's in the neutral zone, before they even get set up.
The forecheck. The most effective way to kill a penalty is to ensure the puck never enters your defensive zone with possession. A power play that is constantly retrieving pucks and trying to break in is a power play that is not utilizing its extra man to generate charts.
How do you stop them at the blue line?
You utilize neutral zone schemes. A team might use a 1-3 scheme, sending one forward deep to apply token pressure and steer the puck carrier, while the other three killers form a horizontal wall across the neutral zone, backing up in unison to deny passing lanes and force the power play to dump the puck in.
What's the alternative?
Alternatively, the 1-1-2 is a heavy NHL default. It layers the defense to bleed clock and force heavily contested entries at the blue line.
I love this framing because it changes the goal.
Yeah.
The whole goal of the forecheck isn't necessarily to steal the puck like a superhero and score shorthanded. The goal is just to ruin their entry.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
If you force the power play into three failed entries where they have to dump it in, lose the foot race, and you clear it down the ice again, the 2 minutes are practically over. You killed the penalty without ever having to block a shot in your own end.
Exactly. You are attacking their time, not just their puck. And if they do successfully enter the zone, the absolute golden rule for every individual penalty killer, the rule that coaches scream from the bench, is the discipline not to chase.
But human nature makes you want to chase.
Yeah.
If a guy is just holding the puck on the perimeter, staring at you,
yeah,
you want to go hit him.
And that is exactly what the power play wants you to do. Every pass around the perimeter is a psychological invitation. They are begging you to bite. If you lunged the puck carrier and missed, you have just created the passing seam yourself. You are doing the work for them.
So what do you do instead? Just stand there.
You rely on geometry, not physicality. You keep your stick blade flat on the ice, extended out in front of your body, directly in the anticipated passing lane.
It sounds minor.
Yeah.
Is it?
This is a subtle but massive detail. A stick in the air does nothing. A stick flat on the ice takes away an entire passing vector. Sticks and lanes act as psychological deterrents. They prevent far more passes from ever being attempted than they actually physically intercept. You take away the seam first, and you only apply pressure when you have structural support behind you.
Okay, let's synthesize the penalty kill so everyone can lock this in.
Yeah.
It is an exercise in structured concession. You decide exactly what shot you are willing to give up by choosing a formation, the box to protect the perimeter, the diamond to protect the slot, or the wedge plus one for aggressive net front protection. You never chase the puck out of your assigned structure. You rely on stick positioning to deter passes, and you focus heavily on ruining their neutral zone entries to bleed the clock.
That covers the structural and tactical foundation on the ice. But a true masterclass requires us to look beyond just where the players stand. We have to look at the invisible forces that govern the very physics of the game.
Oh, man. This is my favorite part of the research we pulled together. This is where the game turns into legal warfare. Let's transition into the hidden levers of special teams, because the rulebook of hockey is absolutely wild.
It is. Hockey is highly unique among major team sports in how its fundamental rules dynamically shift in real time based on the numerical strength of the teams on the ice. The rulebook itself becomes a tactical weapon, and the most critical game-altering lever a penalty kill possesses is the shorthanded icing exemption.
The ultimate weapon. Explain exactly how this breaks the normal rules of the sport.
In a normal 5-on-5 situation, if a team shoots the puck from their own half of the ice all the way down past the opponent's goal line without anyone touching it, it is called an icing infraction.
Right, and the whistle blows.
The whistle blows, the play is stopped, the puck is brought all the way back to the offending team's defensive zone for a face-off, and crucially, the offending team is legally prohibited from changing their tired players. It is a severe punishment designed to prevent teams from just blasting the puck away to relieve pressure.
But on the penalty kill?
On the penalty kill, that rule vanishes. Under the NHL rules, a team that is below the numerical strength of their opponent on the ice is entirely exempt from icing infractions.
Wow.
If you are on the penalty kill and you gain possession of the puck, You can fire it 200 feet down the ice as hard as you want. The play continues without a whistle. The power play team has to skate all the way back to retrieve it while your tired penalty killers casually skate to the bench for a line change. It is the single biggest structural advantage the defense has.
It is a get-out-of-jail-free card. But in our research, we found out that this isn't a universal law. There are massive geographical and league-based differences in how this rule is applied, which completely changes how the game is coached at different levels.
The rulebook geographics are fascinating. If you are playing under the IIHF rulebook, which governs international play and every level of British hockey, this exemption is unconditional. If you are shorthanded, you can ice the puck freely. End of story.
But the NHL has a weird, obscure carve-out that can cost a team dearly.
Yes. In the NHL, if your team takes a 5-minute major penalty, you play shorthanded for the full 5 minutes. However, the rules require you to place a substitute player in the penalty box to serve the time, so that when the penalty expires, someone is there to immediately step onto the ice.
Makes sense.
But if a team's bench administration breaks down in the chaos, and they neglect to put a substitute in the box, their shorthanded icing exemption is actively revoked.
Wow. So you are out there killing a 5-minute major, you clear the puck 200 feet down the ice, and the whistle blows for icing.
I'll be too.
Then assistant coach forgot to tap a guy on the shoulder and tell him to sit in the box.
Exactly. A bench administration error strips you of your primary defensive tool, but the most massive tactical divergence exists in youth hockey in North America. Under USA hockey rules, the shorthanded icing exemption is completely withheld for younger age groups.
This blew my mind. I had no idea they changed this.
It is a massive developmental shift. USA Hockey only grants the shorthanded icing exemption for youth 15 only, girls 16U, high school and adult classifications, and upward. For any age group below those levels, a shorthanded team can and will be called for icing.
That completely changes the paradigm of the game for those kids.
Yeah.
Think about a 12-year-old defenseman on the penalty kill. He's exhausted, the power play is throwing him, he panics, and just hammers the puck down the ice to survive. In the NHL, that's a great play. Under USA Hockey youth rules, the whistle blows, the puck comes all the way back to his defensive zone for a face-off, and his team is right back under siege.
Precisely. USA Hockey implemented this to force youth players to develop puck handling skills, poise, and passing ability under pressure, rather than relying on the crutch of just blindly blasting the puck away. If you are a youth coach, you cannot build a penalty kill system around the traditional clear. You have to teach them to skate it out or execute controlled breakout passes while down a man.
Okay, so assuming you are allowed to clear the puck, you still have to be incredibly careful, because the rulebook is full of self-inflicted wounds. The most common one on the penalty kill is the delay of game penalty for shooting the puck over the glass.
Even when you are desperate on the penalty kill, shooting the puck directly and non-deflected out of the playing surface from your own defending zone is an automatic minor penalty. It doesn't matter if it was an accident.
And that compounds the problem.
Hugely. If you are already down a man, committing this penalty puts you down 2 men for a 5-on-3. Therefore, coaches drill into players to aim their defensive clears hard and flat along the ice, or to aim them high off the safety glass so they rebound and stay in play.
But there's a really bizarre nuance here regarding the players' benches.
The bench geography is a critical loophole. Under both NHL and IIHF rules, if a player shoots the puck straight out of the defensive zone and it lands directly into either player's bench, where there is intentionally a gap in the glass to allow players to change the delay of game penalty, does not apply. It is considered part of the playing environment for this specific rule.
So if you're going to accidentally launch it out, launch it into your teammates' laps.
Exactly. However, if you shoot it over the protective glass that sits behind the bench, it is still a penalty. And the IIHF rulebook is actually written slightly wider than the NHL's here. The IIHF specifies the glass surrounding the bench, which catches the angled side glass as well.
That's incredibly specific.
Yeah, the IIHF situation handbook specifically outlines a scenario where a puck goes over the glass, hits a stanchion, and then drops straight down into the bench area. Because the puck broke the imaginary vertical plane above the glass before landing in the bench, it remains a penalty.
The margins are razor thin. But speaking of self-inflicted wounds, this next rule is the most terrifying thing a defending player can do, and I guarantee most casual fans have no idea the punishment is this severe. What happens if you are completely gassed on the penalty kill? The puck is loose in front of your net, you're trapped, and you just decide to fall on top of it. You smother the puck with your torso to force the referee to blow the whistle so you can get a line change.
Doing that is a catastrophic tactical error. Smothering the puck to force a stoppage of play is a standard delay of game minor penalty for any skater other than the fully equipped goaltender. But the severity scales drastically based on geography.
How so?
Under NHL and IIHF rules, if a skater deliberately falls on, gathers, or sweeps the puck into their body while that puck is located inside their own goal crease, the penalty is immediately escalated to a penalty shot for the opposing team.
Let me make sure I'm hearing this correctly. You are trying to buy your team a 10-second breather, and the punishment is handing the other team a free, uncontested one-on-one breakaway against your goalie.
Yes. And the determining factor is the physical location of the puck, not the offending player's body. A player could have their entire body outside the blue paint, but if they reach in and cover the puck while it is resting inside the crease line, it is a penalty shot.
What if a team has pulled their goalie for an extra attacker at the end of the game, and a defenseman smothers the puck in the empty crease to stop it from going in?
In that specific scenario, because there is no goaltender legally on the ice to defend a penalty shot, the referee will simply award an automatic goal to the attacking team. The game effectively ends on a rules technicality.
That is absolutely brutal. Do USA Hockey and Hockey Canada enforce it the same way?
They do escalate it, but with slight variations. Under USA Hockey, the referee assesses a penalty shot or optional minor penalty, and the chase of punishment belongs entirely to the non-offending team.
Oh, that's almost worse. They get to choose how to hurt you.
Exactly. And a smart coach will often choose the minor penalty instead of the penalty shot, because taking the minor puts the defending team down two men for a full 2 minutes of a 5-on-3 power play, which is often statistically more valuable than a single breakaway attempt. Hockey Canada also escalates the infraction to a penalty shot.
Okay, so the bottom line is,
the overarching tactical rule is absolute, regardless of where you play. As a skater, never, ever deliberately smother the puck in your own crease. Knock it down with a glove, sweep it away with a stick, but never lay on it.
Okay, let's back up to how these special team shifts actually begin. Let's talk about face-offs, winning the starting gun. This isn't just about puck possession. It's about skipping the hardest part of the power play.
Face-offs matter disproportionately on special teams. We discussed earlier how difficult and time-consuming zone entries are. Winning the opening face-off in the offensive zone means the power play completely bypasses the zone entry problem.
You're just instantly set up.
Right. You are instantly set up in your 1-3-1 formation. The rules actively give the power play an edge here. The team awarded the power play gets to dictate geography. They are allowed to choose which of the two end zone face-off dots the draw will take place at.
So they pick the side that sets up their best shooter perfectly. If they want their left-handed sniper on the right half wall to get the puck immediately, they choose the dot that facilitates that exact play.
Precisely. They script the opening sequence. But there is a fatal administrative mistake a power play can make here regarding icing.
Wait, how can a power play ice the puck? They have the man advantage?
It happens more often than you think. A power play loses the draw, retrieves the puck in their own end, tries to force a fast breakout pass through the neutral zone, misses the target, and the puck sails all the way down the ice. That is icing against the power play.
And what is the punishment? Because normally icing just brings the faceoff back.
It is a cascading disaster. First, the faceoff comes all the way back to the power play's defensive zone, meaning they now have to execute a breakout and a zone entry just to get back to where they started. Second, because they ice the puck, the penalty kill now gets to choose which faceoff dot is used.
That hurts.
But third, and most devastatingly, under NHL and IIHF rules, the team that committed the icing infraction is legally banned from changing their players, and they are banned from taking a timeout to rest them.
So you have your top power play unit, your most highly skilled, offensive-minded forwards, who probably don't play a lot of defensive minutes, trapped on the ice, completely exhausted, forced to take a defensive zone face-off against a fresh penalty-killing unit.
It completely inverts the advantage. It is a disaster.
What about the mechanics of the face-off itself? What happens if a guy jumps the gun?
Face-off violations are strictly policed. If a winger on the face-off encroaches, meaning their skate crosses the line into the circle, or their stick crosses into the hash marks before the puck is dropped, the referee blows the whistle. But under NHL rules, and recently adopted IIHF rules as well, the encroaching winger isn't the one punished. The center taking the faceoff is ejected from the dot and replaced by another player on the ice.
So your winger gets too eager, makes a mistake. And, as punishment, your team's designated faceoff specialist the guy who practices this exact skill for hours gets thrown out of the circle on the most important draw of the game.
Exactly. You are forced to rely on the winger and take a crucial draw. Furthermore, a second face-off violation by the same team on the same stoppage of play results in a bench minor penalty for delay of game.
Wow.
Yeah. If you are already on the penalty kill and you commit two face-off violations, you just turn a 5-on-4 disadvantage into a catastrophic 5-on-3 disadvantage without the puck even being in play.
The margins for error are just non-existent. Let's shift focus slightly and touch on the goalie's sphere of influence during all this. Goalies aren't just sitting ducks tied to the crossbar. They can actively play the puck and disrupt a power play's dump in attempts.
They can, but only where the rulebook permits. The NHL and the IIHF enforce the trapezoid rule. This rule restricts where goaltenders can legally handle the puck behind the goal line. They are only allowed to touch the puck within a marked trapezoid-shaped area directly behind the net.
So they can't go into the corners.
Right. If a penalty kill aggressively rims the puck hard around the glass to clear it, the goaltender cannot skate into the deep corner to stop it. If they play the puck outside the trapezoid behind the goal line, it is an automatic minor penalty.
But again, this isn't universal, right?
Correct. Under USA Hockey, Hockey Canada, and adult recreational leagues, the word trapezoid does not even exist in the rulebook. The restrictions are entirely absent. In those leagues, a goaltender can act as a genuine third defenseman behind the net. They can skate into any corner, fetch a rimmed puck, and immediately fire it back out. This makes clearing the puck significantly easier for a penalty kill at those levels, because the goalie acts as a massive backstop.
But they can't just freeze it in the corner, right?
No. Even without the trapezoid, a goaltender who skates out of their crease and deliberately freezes the puck against the boards without being under immediate overwhelming pressure will be assessed a delay of game minor penalty across all rulebooks. The goalie must keep the play moving.
What about the physical interaction between the attackers and the goalie? In a 1-3-1, you have that net front player who makes a living standing inches away from the goalie, screening them, bumping them. Where is the line between a good screen and illegal interference?
The rules for crease interference are incredibly strict, but the philosophy of enforcement varies heavily by the rulebook. Under USA Hockey, it is practically a strict liability position bar.
Let's explain that.
The rule dictates that no goal may be scored if an attacking player is standing in the goal crease, unless the puck entered the crease before the player did, or unless a defending player physically shoved the attacker into the paint. Even momentarily skating through the blue paint of the crease while your team has possession of the puck in the attacking zone can result in an immediate whistle and the faceoff being moved out into the neutral zone.
Just for skating through it. You don't even have to touch the goalie.
Exactly. It prioritizes the goaltender's absolute right to unimpeded space. The NHL and the IIHF operate on a slightly different philosophy, based more on contact and visual interference. They govern whether the attacking player physically impaired the goalie's ability to move freely within the crease or establish their position. You can occasionally have a skate in the paint in the NHL if it doesn't impact the goalie's mechanics.
But deliberately hitting the goalie is punished severely everywhere.
Deliberately charging or making aggressive contact with the goaltender carries massive penalties across all books. Under USA Hockey, charging a goaltender while they are within their privilege area, which extends far beyond the crease, from the face-off spots all the way to the end boards results in an automatic minor penalty plus a 10-minute misconduct or potentially a major penalty and game misconduct.
A 10-minute misconduct. If you take that on the power play, your 2-minute advantage is dead and you're sitting in the box for a third of a period.
It is a devastating penalty to take. The tactical lesson for a net front player is clear. You establish your screen and hunt for tips from outside the blue paint of the crease. You leverage your physical positioning against the defenseman, but you never initiate contact with the goaltender to carve out room.
Let's pause and lock in the mental model for rulebook warfare. So remember this, icing is the penalty kill's absolute greatest weapon, allowing free 200-foot clears, unless you're coaching youth hockey under USA Hockey, in which case you have to actually break the puck out. Never ever smother a loose puck with your torso in your own crease unless you actively want to face a penalty shot. Choose your offensive faceoff dot wisely. Discipline your winger so your center doesn't get tossed. And if you are on the power play, do not accidentally ice the puck and trap your tired superstars on the ice.
That is a perfect distillation of the hidden levers. Understanding these rules allows a coach or player to find advantages in the margins where pure speed and skill cannot. Now, we must move to our final conceptual area. What happens when the ice opens up completely?
We've talked about 5-on-4, 5-on-3, 4-on-5. But what about when both teams are missing players? What about 4-on-4 and 3-on-3?
Let's begin with 4-on-4. This usually occurs when two players engage in an altercation and take coincidental minor penalties.
Though, once again, the rulebook throws a curveball here, depending on where you play.
Yes. Under NHL rules, coincidental minor penalties resulting in neither team gaining a numerical advantage dictate that both teams play with four skaters. The ice opens up. Under IIHF rules, however, coincidental minors typically result in immediate substitution from the bench.
So they just play 5-on-5.
Exactly. The penalized players go to the box, but their teams put fresh players on the ice, keeping the play at 5-on-5, unless it's a specific minor against major scenario.
But for the sake of strategy, let's assume we're playing 4-on-4. What changes mechanically?
Everything changes because you have eliminated a layer of the safety net. With two fewer bodies on the ice, each individual player suddenly has a massive increase in square footage to work with, and that extra room is primarily located in the dangerous middle of the ice. Pure skating speed, edge work, and individual puck skills begin to matter far more than rigid defensive formations.
It becomes a track meet.
It does. And crucially, because you only have two forwards on the ice instead of three, you have one fewer player available to backcheck. A traditional 5-on-5 rush might face three layers of defense. A 4-on-4 rush often faces only one. A 2-on-1 counterattack develops exponentially faster and with significantly more room for the attackers to operate laterally.
So defensemen have to completely rewire their risk assessment matrix.
Absolutely. A defenseman must be incredibly cautious about activating and jumping up into the offensive rush during 4-on-4 play. The wide open ice is deeply tempting, but the punishment for a turnover or a missed pinch is catastrophic. If a defenseman pinches and misses, there is no third forward high in the zone to cover for them.
They're just gone.
It is an instant odd man rush the other way. Furthermore, line changes require extreme precision. Executing a sloppy line change while the puck is live at 4-on-4 essentially hands the opponent a free zone entry against only three defenders.
Okay, so if 4-on-4 is a track meet, 3-on-3 overtime is just sheer madness.
If we pull back and look at the bigger picture, 3-on-3 hockey is functionally basketball played on ice. Traditional hockey concepts evaporate. There is no forecheck worth the name because committing a player to chase the puck deep in the offensive zone leaves you vulnerable to a 2-on-1 the other way.
So it's all about possession.
Right. There is no sustained offensive cycle along the boards. There is nowhere to hide defensively. The entire format boils down to puck possession and manufacturing odd man rushes.
And because possession is so valuable, you cannot give the puck away. You literally cannot be scored on while you have the puck. Which leads us to the most controversial, hated strategy in modern hockey, the regroup.
Fans despise it, but
Yeah.
tactically, it is flawless.
Paint the picture for the listener. A player carries the puck over the offensive blue line. The crowd roars. He skates down the wing, looks at the defense, realizes he doesn't have a clean, high-danger shot or an open passing lane, and instead of shooting, he just slams on the brakes, turns around, and skates the puck all the way back out into the neutral zone, sometimes all the way back behind his own net. The crowd boos mercilessly.
They boo because they want action, but the player is executing brilliant possession retention. If he forces a low probability shot from the outside and the goalie makes an easy save and freezes the puck, the resulting face-off is a 50-50 coin flip for possession. By pulling the puck back out, circling the wagons, and allowing his teammates to weave and build speed from the defensive zone, he guarantees that his team retains possession for a second, better coordinated attack.
It's so effective that the NHL actively hates it.
They are deeply concerned about the entertainment value. NHL general managers spent significant time at their meetings discussing potential rule changes to limit or outright ban the regroup. They debated implementing an over and back rule similar to basketball, where once you cross the blue line, you cannot voluntarily bring the puck back out. However, discussion is not adoption. As of the current rules, the regroup remains entirely legal and highly encouraged by coaches.
What about changing lines in 3-on-3? Because the shifts are so taxing, guys are gassed after 40 seconds.
Line changes in 3-on-3 are terrifying. You should never attempt a change on the fly while the puck is loose or contested in the neutral zone. A bad change is an instant breakaway for the opponent. Teams will secure possession, deliberately pass the puck all the way back to their own goaltender or a trailing defenseman, and hold the puck stationary while the tired players sprint to the bench and fresh players jump on.
But a goalie can't just put their glove on it and force a whistle to get new guys out there, right?
No. As we discussed earlier, a goaltender who deliberately freezes the puck in their crease while entirely unpressured, simply to secure a whistle for a line change, will be assessed a delay of game minor penalty across all rule books. The goalie must play the puck, acting as a pivot point for the regroup.
Before we wrap up the tactical breakdown, we have to talk about the transition moments, the exact seconds when a penalty expires and the ice shifts back to even strength.
The 3 seconds surrounding a penalty expiration are statistically some of the most dangerous, chaotic moments in a hockey game. If you are the power play unit, you must have acute awareness of the game clock. It is a known psychological phenomenon that penalty killers often relax slightly, exhaling in the final 10 seconds, waiting for their fifth man to jump on the ice to relieve them. That moment of relaxed structure is a power play's best chance to strike with a quick seam pass.
And if you are the penalty kill, someone on the ice has to communicate.
The communication must be loud and immediate. Man coming out! Whoever is nearest to the penalty box side of the ice must call it out.
Because the guy leaving the box isn't just a guy, he's a weapon. We used to call it the sprint.
It is a devastating advantage. The player leaving the penalty box is fully rested. He is skating at maximum velocity. He is entering the play from a bizarre angle on the side of the rink. And most importantly, because he didn't exist in the defensive structure 2 seconds ago, absolutely nobody on the power play is assigned to cover him.
Like a ghost appearing.
Exactly. If the penalty kill manages to intercept the puck at the exact moment the penalty expires, they will immediately fire a stretch pass to that sprinting player for a clean breakaway. For 3 seconds, that player is the most dangerous entity on the ice.
Okay, the final extreme scenario. What happens when a team is on the power play, but they are losing late in the game, so they pull their goaltender to add an extra attacker? You end up with a 6-on-4 advantage.
A 6-on-4 is the largest numerical advantage legally allowed in hockey. But interestingly, coaches utilize it far less frequently than the raw arithmetic suggests they should.
Why is that? 2 extra guys seems like an automatic goal.
Having 2 extra attackers against 4 penalty killers means that genuine 2-on-1s exist everywhere on the ice simultaneously. The offensive possibilities are endless. But the penalty kill has the ultimate countermeasure available to them, the empty net.
Because of the icing exemption.
Exactly. Because a shorthanded team can legally ice the puck without penalty, they don't have to carry it out. Any penalty killer who wins a battle along the boards or intercepts a pass can simply turn and blast the puck 180 feet down the ice toward the empty net. If it goes in, it counts, and the game is effectively over.
The risk is enormous.
If it misses the net, it's not an icing violation. The power play just has to skate all the way back to retrieve it. Because the risk of conceding a 200-foot empty net goal is so high, the power play must move the puck with incredible precision, and they have to accept that shooting lanes will be heavily crowded with desperate defenders willing to block shots with their faces to seal the victory.
Wow. Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today.
Yeah.
We have traversed the formations, the biomechanics, the tracking data, and the legal warfare of the rule books. It is time for our final mastery review. Let us comprehensively synthesize everything we have discussed into one coherent, unified mental framework that our listeners can take with them.
An expert mentally organizes all of this information by recognizing one overarching theme. Special teams are fundamentally an exercise in managing resource asymmetry. Every formation, every pass, every rule is just a tool to manipulate time and space.
So how does the power play fit into that framework?
The power play uses puck velocity, structured movement, and specific geometry, specifically the pursuit of crossing the Royal Road to stretch the finite resources of the defense to their absolute breaking point. The 1-3-1 formation isn't magic. It is simply a spatial tool designed to exploit the unassigned center of a defensive box. The Royal Road isn't just a line. It is a biomechanical attack on the goaltender's physical ability to track and recover.
And the penalty kill.
The penalty kill uses disciplined shape like the box or the diamond to manage and mitigate that stretch. It is an exercise in controlled concession. Furthermore, the penalty kill leverages strategic levers hidden within the rule book, like the shorthanded icing exemption, to survive the mathematical disadvantage.
If you take absolutely nothing else from this massive deep dive, if you only remember 3 concrete principles to permanently upgrade your understanding of hockey, what are the 3 rules?
Number 1, pass. Don't just skate. The extra skater is worthless until you force a defender to cover 2 men. The pass that ultimately beats the penalty kill is usually the second rapid pass in a sequence. The first pass makes the defensive shape move. The second pass arrives in the empty space where they used to be.
Number two, discipline over effort. If you are defending down a man, you must decide exactly what shot you are willing to concede, build a shape that protects against everything else, and never, ever chase the puck out of your structure to try and be a hero.
And number three, know the rulebook, lovers. Shorthanded icing is your absolute best friend and greatest defensive weapon, unless you are coaching youth hockey in the United States. And smothering a loose puck with your torso inside your own goal crease is your worst nightmare, because it will immediately result in a penalty shot against your goaltender.
It really is a chessboard played at 30 miles an hour, where every piece is constantly moving, and the rules change depending on how many pieces you have left. Which leads me to a final provocative thought for everyone listening to mull over today. We spent an hour talking about hockey, but think about how these exact principles of resource asymmetry apply outside the rink.
The parallels to strategic management in life are profound.
Exactly. When you find yourself with an overwhelming advantage in business, in a negotiation, or in life, do you just rush in blindly with brute force, assuming the math will save you? Or do you use patience, spacing, and puck movement, quote-unquote, to pull the opposition entirely out of their comfortable shape before you strike?
And conversely, when you find yourself outgunned, under-resourced, and facing a massive disadvantage, do you panic? Do you expend all your energy chasing every single problem that pops up? Or do you build a mental box, intentionally concede the perimeter, fiercely protect what matters most in the center, and bleed the clock until you survive the storm?
It isn't just a binary state of winning or losing. It is about actively managing the murky, chaotic waters of the system you are operating within. Thank you so much for joining this Deep Dive Masterclass. Take these mental models onto the ice, take them into your next viewing of a game, or take them into your own life. We'll see you next time.